Okay, this is tape three, continuing the interview with Frank Applin on July 20th, 1998. And you had just started to talk about the mail process at Climax.
And they would get, they used block cave underground, and we'd get boulders up to about 3 foot, come out on a train from the mine. This was went to the crusher building where it was knocked down to about half inch. It then went to the mill silos, half inch feeding 9x8 ball mills with about 450 horsepower motors. And they used a very coarse grind. I'll talk about that a little later, but in more detail. But what they did is they ended up with about 13% plus 35 mesh, which is one of the coarsest grinds in the industry. And the reason is that molybdenite, MOS2, is so easy to float that even if any little molybdenite shows up on the outside of a particle, it will float quite easily. So the recovery is very easy. The reagents were essentially pine oil, an oil called vapor oil, and a little detergent to emulsify the oil. And so they ground it to 13% plus 35 and floated it. They floated they started with roughly 0.35% MOS2, molybdenum disulfide, and they floated about 5% of the total tonnage at 6% MOS2. So that at that point, they were able to throw away 95% of the tonnage and not process it further. This is helpful because the largest single cost in milling is the grinding cost. So grinding very coarse. Most copper flotation plants will grind to minus 65 mesh, so quite a bit finer. So in this case, we were grinding half as fine. I mean, there's about 65 mesh is about 2/10 of a millimeter, and we were grinding to about a half, 13% plus a half millimeters, and some particles as coarse as 1 millimeter, so that's quite a bit coarser, and the grinding cost is much less to
do
it.
And still getting good recovery.
Very good. It was still over 90%. Then that was taken to, the 5% of the tonnage was taken to a regrind plant where we used multiple grinding and multiple grind, float, grind, float, grind, float, taking the good stuff all the time and progressing it. And they would end up with, say, 94% MOS2 when they got through. Later, they developed a market for lubricant-grade molybdenum disulfide, and they put in more stages of grinding and floating, and they got it up to well into the high 90s by that process. But they got a premium for that. The lubricant-grade gathered more than the moly that was used for ferroalloys. When I first went up there, we were running about 6,000 tons a day, which is one of the reasons they weren't hiring much. They had a mill with a capacity of almost 20,000 tons a day, and they were running only about a third of it. The Korean War started, and molybdenum is very necessary in hardening steel and making quality steel. So suddenly the demand for molybdenum went sky high. We had a big warehouse full of barrels of concentrate that hadn't been sold, and they shipped every bunch they had. It took them several months just to get it shipped out. They had so much in storage. And then they cranked up the mill to 18 to 20,000 tons. Now, They did that by, we were using only a few of the ball mill float circuits. We had multiple circuits. We had 8 lines of grinding and flotation. And we were using maybe 3 of them, and suddenly we were using all of them. And in addition, they had a high speed, they had 2 trunnions. The gears on the grinding mills, and that they put in a high-speed trunnion. When Molly wasn't selling very well, you wanted a high recovery, so they put in a low speed. They used a grind that was about nothing minus 30, plus 35. They got a higher recovery, 95. But when you could sell Molly, the idea is to sell Molly. And so they put in a high-speed trunnion, they made a coarser grind, and they dropped the recovery to about 90. So it's a trade-off of recovery and capacity. But they needed all the Molly they can get.
But they had the capacity already. They must at previous times have needed them.
Yeah, they left over from World War II.
During World War II.
They had the capacity. But they kept waiting for the times to come back and putting the Molly in the stockpile, and suddenly they found out they couldn't sell it, so they...
But then...
But when the Korean War started, they sold a lot of Molly. The most interesting thing about the process was that the ore contained a trace. We're talking like 0.027% of tungsten, and about the same amount of monazite, a cerium rare earth phosphate. M-O-N-A-Z-I-T-E, and a little bit of cassiterite, SNO2, the tin oxide.
That has 2 S's?
Cassiterite, C-A-S-S-I-T-E-R-I-T-E. And that was there probably at about 0.002%. And they worked out a process. This was done by A.J. Weinig down at Colorado School of Mines. He was a consultant for Climax. And they had a research lab in Denver, or in Golden. And that was headed up by Bob Cuthbertson. And then the local staff. And in the late 40s, they developed a most unusual plant to recover all this stuff. Let me describe the plant basically. Unless you know something about mining, it may not mean much, but for those that do, it was a fascinating plant. They took the flotation tails and they ran it to a high wear Aikens classifier. The slime overflow.
What kind of classifier?
AKINS.
But you said a high?
Weir, W-E-I-R.
Okay.
The slimes went to waste, though later we took the slimes and sent them to a hydrocyclone and recovered extra coarse material. I don't mean extra coarse, I mean additional coarse material. The sands then from the classifier went to Humphrey Sparks. They had 218 of them, or 216 of them. I guess 216 spirals. And the spiral concentrate then went to shaking tables. The concentrate from the rougher tables went to a cleaner shaking table. The concentrate from the shaking tables was sent to flotation where pyrite was floated away. This was all done wet. It then was sent to a tramp for tramp iron removal in a Crockett, C-R-O-K-E-T-T, magnetic separator. The material was dried and sent over an eight-pole Wetherill, W-E-T-H-E-R-I-L-L, magnetic separator.
Eight-pole.
Yes. It had different ampere turns, so they had different magnet strengths as you went on down the line.
Okay.
Actually, there were two separate four-pole machines, but that's a detail.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled from this wolframite, a tungsten mineral, iron manganese tungsten mineral, monazite, the cerium rare earth phosphate, black minerals such as rutile, and the tails were quartz, pyrite, and cassiterite, some pyrite that got by the flotation process. Now that was run every day, every shift, and one operator ran that whole thing.
Mm.
Periodically, like depending on how much we were running, but maybe several times a month, we would run a flotation plant to remove the monazite from the wolframite. The wolframite was going to go for steel making, and you don't want phosphorus in steel.
Mm.
So there was phosphorus in the monazite, so you had to get the monazite away from the wolframite. Then the monazite was valuable. It was used as rare earths were used as an inoculant in the foundries, an additive. And so we had to remove any trace of the magnetic separator wasn't perfect. So, you know, some minerals got in the wrong places a little bit. So we had to clean it up by flotation. And so we cleaned up the monazite and then recovered from the tails of the monazite flotation more wolframite, which then went to the other circuit. And then the tails from the magnetic separators contained the cassiterite, and we used more gravity separation to recover cassiterite, tin.
Mm.
And we had the largest tin source in the United States. It was dinky, but it was still largest because there wasn't any other.
Mm-hmm.
The only other one there was Good News Bay up in Alaska, and that was shut down at the time. Now, it gets even more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I said when they took the spiral concentrate and tabled it,
mm-hmm.
the tails from the table contained fluorite and topaz, and that went over to a special gravity circuit of more spirals and more shaking tables, and then they floated the fluoride away from the topaz. The topaz was used to put in the grout used to tile and shower stalls and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Of the cement in between, they'd put the topaz in, and it would take a better polish and stand up better.
For heaven's sake.
And fluoride could be sold, so mostly for metallurgical purposes.
So they were really selling
So
everything.
It was a fascinating plant, and
mm-hmm.
even as a laborer, I worked in that plant. Fact is, I worked as underneath man on the spirals.
Oh.
You should have got rain pay for that because it was just a deluge under those spirals.
Oh.
But it was interesting and a fascinating operation.
I'm always interested in what you wore when you were working in this place.
This plain old work clothes.
Okay. Did they issue you any
special? No. In those days, you never got anything. The only place I ever know of anyone got issued clothing was in the Homestake Refinery.
Hmm.
Because at the end of, when the clothes got worn out at the Homestake Refinery, they burned them and they were worth more at the end of their useful life than they were when they were bought new. Because of the pickup of precious metals in the refinery.
But you provided your own boots and
everything.
I just wore a good
didn't require any safety glasses or anything in those days.
Gloves?
Yeah, if you were doing rough stuff, like at Homestake and the Bow Gang, always wore gloves because it was heavy work.
Mm-hmm.
But I was mostly in the wet at the climax, so yeah. I didn't want any
what
gloves.
What sort of safety training or precautions were there at climax?
They had a safety engineer who, in my opinion, didn't do very much. But again, most of the people employed were knowledgeable. The mill had a good quality employee. Mine, some they had, some not so good. Mm-hmm. But the mill had very, very good quality employees. Leadville had been hit kind of hard, so this was a good job for a person living in Leadville. And so a lot of the people were experienced, had worked in lead zinc mills and so forth, or worked at the ASR smelter at Leadville. Mm-hmm. So there was always something like that with good quality people. And I don't know of any, I know of no lost time accidents in the entire time I was there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, people who were raised around mining camps and so forth, they know how to take care of themselves.
Was this a union? Did you join a union? Did you need
When I was a laborer, I had joined a union.
Mm-hmm. What union was it?
It was the Climax Molybdenum Workers.
Oh, they had their own?
A separate union. They had been part of the Mine Mill and Smelter, and Mine Mill and Smelter was infiltrated by the communists pretty heavily at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy came out from Denver and told them to vote for Henry Wallace, and one of the guys said, I'll give you 5 minutes to get out of town.
Ooh.
He got, and they seceded and joined the AFL as a separate union.
Mm-hmm.
There was a good management-labor relationship there, and it was a very, very, during my era, they had a little trouble afterwards, but during my era, that was a very happy situation.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an example, there were a number of kids from the East, from the Ivy League, out working in the summer. They were, one of them was a nephew of Bunker, who was president, and he brought his friends from Princeton and so forth out. And they had joined the union, and they were amazed at how democratic the union was run and so forth,
really?
Because, they had been raised on some of these other stories that weren't so democratic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some of the Eastern unions weren't quite that democratic. But this thing was a very democratic, and it was very good, very fair. I know of no problems.
Mm.
And I said the union meetings were run fair and square.
Mm-hmm.
And I said they had really impressed these kids because they had grown up in another system.
Sure.
And they were amazed that there could be such a thing as a fair union.
Was this your first time to join a union?
Yeah.
In Idaho, you didn't need to?
No. Well, because I wasn't working as a miner, I was working I was on staff.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have that problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got, when I got on staff, I got the magnificent sum of $208 a month.
At Climax?
Climax.
Oh, wonderful.
So I didn't get any pay raise, essentially, go from labor to staff.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it was a more prestigious job, and of course, you moved around the mill.
Mm-hmm.
And that job as a mill accountant and in the chem lab, I still know a lot of the analysis from that whole damn plant. I've still got them in my head because I had to work with them. And we had to have every night by 4:15, the mill sheets had to be on the teletype to New York.
Mm-hmm.
When they came in the morning in New York, we shut down at 4:30. When they came in New York, at 9 o'clock in the morning, they wanted to know what the previous mill sheets looked like. So that had to all be done one way or another. And so when I was in the chem lab and when I was in this metallurgical accounting, it was a pressure cooker, if something happened, a sample was spilled or something like that, and the camera, it was a mess. You somehow had to do something.
It was really run that closely from New York.
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
No, the bottom line was run, because, you see, then the concentrate then went to Langlois, Pennsylvania for smelting.
Where?
Langlois. L-A-N-G-L-O-T-H.
Okay.
They've sold that since, and it's now done somewhere in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay.
One more question. Where were you living?
I'll talk about that later.
Okay.
At this time, first time I was up there, I lived in a boarding house.
Okay.
Well, as long as we're on the boarding house, I might as well talk about this one now. In the spring of 1951, I and all the kids in Climax got the mumps. Okay. So I was living in the boarding house, and so they had to pull me out of there right away, because all of the miners were worried about family jewels, and so they put me in the hospital. Well, after I no longer was contagious, I was still swollen, and so they said, just take a pass and get out of here for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in the car and I drove down to Telluride, and outside of Telluride was a mine called Telluride Mines. It was later taken over by Iditarod, a division of Newmont. The mill is still sitting there at Pandora. I was with there last summer, but it's not run as a mill anymore. Telluride Mines had it was a lead zinc operation, silver, and the metallurgist was Elton Geist, G-E-I-S-T, from who was a year ahead of me at South Coast School of Mines. So, you know, what goes around comes around. And so I went through that mill. That was an interesting time, because the Rio Grande Southern, a very popular narrow gauge railroad for us railroad buffs, was still running at that time. And I'll pick up on that a little later. In addition to this, underneath my own spiral, I worked on test work on plant flotation operations, efficiency in the crushers, cassiterite flotation testing, and I did some work with a tilting frame on gravity concentration of cassiterite. One of the most interesting things, though, was to work. We had one of the first hydrocyclones in use in the ore industry. The hydrocyclone was developed in Europe at the Dutch State Mines. And at the end of World War II, the Commerce Department sent experts in all fields of technology to Europe. And one of the guys in mining was Dr. H.F. Yancey from the Bureau of Mines. I'll talk about him later. And he was at the Northwest Experiment Station in Seattle on the university campus. And Yancey saw this cyclone, which had been developed by a guy by the name of Dreesen, D-R-E-I-S-S-E-N, at the Dutch State Mines. And he brought it back to the States. It was used for several years in the coal industry, and there were big ads, oh, it's wonderful, it has no wear, etc. But of course, that was on coal. And ore wasn't so good. So the mill metallurgist at the time was Ed Froehling, and he had had his bachelor's from MIT, and Godin had had him working on this new cyclone, so he knew about cyclones. So we put together a cyclone, and we were going to cyclone the overflow from that high wear Aikens classifier in order to get a little bit of coarse, extra coarse material to send to the Humphrey spiral to increase the recovery of tin, tungsten, and monazite. And so we knocked one together and put it in there, and after running a few hours, we just made it out of sheet metal in a conical had a barrel section, cylindrical and then a conical section, and the ore came in and slurry and was spun around like this. Well, the Climax ore was quartz monzonite injected by quartz, and so it was about the most abrasive ore you could find. Mm-hmm. And that thing holed through the cyclone, and here we're dealing with 1,000 gallons a minute going across the mill building,
oh,
splattering against a wall.
Oh.
So at that time, Linatex had come out.
Hmm.
Linatex was L-I-N-A-T-E-X, Linatex. And was a soft, unvulcanized rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And it had tremendous resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using a lot to line chutes, feeding, grinding mills, and all kinds of stuff because of its abrasion. And so we got some of that. I'm the one who did it. I was still a laborer at this time. So I was given the job of doing it. I took this Linatex and the rubber cement lined the inside of the cyclone.
Oh.
Well, I was kind of like Briar Rabbit and the Tar Baby because I had that glue all over me, and everything you touched, your hands would stick to that stuff. But one way or another, we got that thing lined with Linatex, and it ran for months before we did a proper job and got a proper one in. So that was one of the early... I think the first use of a cyclone was probably at Tahawus, New York, in the of the National Lead's titanium division. This is upstate New York, way upstate, up by Lake Champlain in that area. That was probably the first use. They had one at Telluride Mines, too, because Geist had been at Tahawa, so when he came out to Telluride, he knew about it.
I've heard of it, though, quite early. I've interviewed Bob Clarkson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he worked with hydrocyclones very early. In Idaho, I'm trying to remember.
Probably in the late 40s.
Did he have one at Bunker Hill?
I never saw one at Bunker, but they may have had one, who knows. But there were quite a few people messing around with cyclones 49, 50, 51.
Yeah.
It
might have been out in California that he was using.
The experience, because of abrasion, was so bad. So until something like Linatex came along.
They just couldn't.
They couldn't do it. Whereas coal, which wasn't abrasive, they didn't have any problems.
Sure.
And I saw big ads in Mining Engineering about how good they were, but they weren't very good for ore.
No.
But we solved that problem. Then one day, they came to me, the mill soup got a hold of me and said, "The water plant foreman has just quit. You're the water plant foreman." I said, "I don't know anything about water plant." He said, "There are two books up there." The foreman's gone. What they did for potable water, Climax had several little retention dams on the side of Mount Bartlett, where the, if you've driven past there, it's where the, it's been caved now, it's where the big pit is.
Is that but the Henderson mine?
The one? No, Henderson's underneath. Oh, no, Henderson is at Dillon.
Mm.
They had little dams on there, and they'd take that, but of course they would run out after a while. Then they would take mine water. Well, the problem with mine water is it contained about 15-20 ppm of fluorine. And 15 or 20 ppm of fluorine will model the enamel in your teeth. 1 ppm is good to keep the teeth in the fluoride form, but 15 or 20 ppm will model the enamel and take the teeth out of your head. So a lot of the kids raised in Climax in the 30s had false teeth. They lost teeth. And then when that wasn't enough water, we needed, in the camp, we needed about 200,000 gallons a day of potable water for the houses, for the mill, mine, etc. Not for the process, for the drinking water systems and so on. And then toward before the new runoff came, they got short of water, so they had to divert tailings water. So the tailings came out of the plant, went down to a tailings pond, and they pumped the water back into the mill and reused it again. They diverted some of it to a little dam just off the property, off the main property, called Buffers. And the Buffers Dam would use some of this water, and then they'd have to bleed some of that water into the potable water in order to make up enough water. Well, remember I said we used a little bit of pine oil in the flotation? Well, pine oil is very persistent. And before the spring war and runoff came, we were using quite a bit of tailing water, and it made a very aromatic cup of tea. it was an interesting story told. Before Dessau came in as mill superintendent, the mill superintendent had been E.J. Duggan, who was quite a well-known mineral process engineer. He had run the last Kennecott, Alaska plant for Kennecott. They had an ore involved ammonia leaching of the malachite and azurite and some chalcocite. And it was a fascinating plant. And Duggan was kind of a very strong man. And the water plant was under the direction of the mill suit. And people would come to him and complain about the pine oil and the water. He said, oh, there's no problem. Wasn't until later that we found out that he had the janitor in the dry, the change room, bring bottles of water up from Leadville for his use.
For his tea.
Since I was the water platform, they'd come to me and yell about that water. I couldn't do anything about it. In the water plant, we had to extremely...
Would that pine oil hurt anybody? Would it?
Oh, EPA probably wouldn't like it today, but I never heard of anyone.
So.
Well, I'm 75 and I'm not dead yet.
That's right.
From the pine water, from pine oil. But it did make a good aromatic cup of tea.
Wouldn't taste good at all.
A few years later, they did away with that little thing. But anyway, in the water plant, they took the mine water. They used alum to flocculate fine particles, ran the thing over a rapid sand filter, a big vat full of sand, and when the alum would coagulate as a... aluminum hydroxysulfate together with fine particles, and then that kind of slimy material would stick to the sand particles, and then you'd get clean water out the bottom. The standard for a filtration plant. But we had to defluorinate. So
What?
Defluorinate.
Defluorinate.
From 15 to 20 ppm down to about 1 ppm of fluorine. And it was done this way.
Just a second. Okay, so this is the defluorination.
Okay, the defluorination plant worked this way. From the rapid sand filters, we had tanks of calcium phosphate.
Rapid sand?
Sand filter.
Okay.
We had tanks of calcium phosphate and ran the water over the calcium phosphate. The fluorine would precipitate as calcium fluoride, CaF2, and the phosphorus would go into solution. not much because, you know, we're only dealing with 15 ppm. And that would take the water down to about 1 ppm of fluorine. Then we had several tanks, and we'd take one tank offline, and we'd use sodium hydroxide to remove the fluorine from the calcium phosphate, surface of the calcium phosphate, so the calcium fluoride would be removed by sodium hydroxide. Mm-hmm. Then the thing was back flushed with water and neutralized with carbonic acid. We would use either dry ice or a liquid CO2 and make carbonic acid, CO3, and H2CO3, and neutralize the material. Then the water coming out would be, you know, when you put new stuff in, new raw water in, you wouldn't have any strong alkalinity in the water. Mm-hmm. Then we chlorinate the water and put it into the system. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from the two books. And so mm-hmm. When I came here at Penn State, I made use of a lot of this because we have this geo-environmental engineering degree. So mm-hmm. when I have students say in elements of mineral processing, I'll tell them about a plant like this and what they can do, because this was an extreme, probably the only plant of its kind in the country or in the world. Mm-hmm. Most of the plants that have fluorine, such as Iowa, Dakota, and so forth, only about 1 ppm, and it's good. The teeth mm-hmm. are made of the mineral apatite, mm-hmm. and you've got to keep it in the fluoride form. This is why you use stannous fluoride mm-hmm. in toothpaste, to keep that the surface in the fluorine form, because the hydroxy form of apatite is soft, and so a little bit of fluorine is good. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot is bad.
Bad, yes. Let me ask you before we go any farther about a couple of Ruffers is R-O-U-G-H, isn't it?
R-O-U-G-H-E-R.
Now, you said way back here, I'm going to turn. Okay, so you solved your education with the water plant.
Yeah. Now, the Leadville at that time was a laissez-faire mining camp.
Mm-hmm.
Except for gambling. The people from the Attorney General's office in Denver used to love to come up and raid Leadville. It was close enough, they'd get up there in a few hours and they could have a nice raid. Usually they'd raid the bars. The gambling was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have a raid of the bars or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it had a fascinating history.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about it, though, that the town, this was when I first went up there, 1950, looked like made out of shacks.
Mm-hmm.
Most buildings not painted, etc. The only really good house was the Healy House, which is now a museum,
mm-hmm.
and Public Service of Colorado and Bell Telephone. They had good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found out that if you painted your house, they would come around and adjust your taxes.
Oh.
So people did a tremendous job of fixing. The houses were tremendous inside.
Uh-huh.
But outside, they left old boards out there, because if they painted it, they would, or if they saw anyone making an addition, they'd come around and retax them.
Uh-huh.
Even though it, you know, this laissez-faire has a lot of valuable features mm-hmm. to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
The I've always enjoyed Leadville. Over the years, I've stepped back many, many times. I've got probably a dozen books on Leadville and I don't know, a couple dozen pamphlets and magazines and stuff like that. And I've got over 100 Western Ghost Mine books. One of the interesting things I had is on July 4th, they used to have the burro races. And they would, they had a standard pack, you know, you had to have a pick and a, and a gold pan, and they would some a certain weight, put it on the burro, take it over Mosquito Pass, and they used to run the, over to Fairplay in South Park. And a Fairplay was interesting. They had, it's still there. It, downtown, Fairplay, a very small town, in the last couple of years, there's been a tremendous building boom in Fairplay. So Fairplay is, I don't know, 10 times the size it was.
Really?
Before, I doubt if there were 100 people in Fairplay in this era. And downtown in Fairplay, they have a monument to Prunes, a burro. And Prunes died in 1930 and was reputed to be 63 years old when he died. So you get this monument to the burro. But anyway, the burro race went over Fairplay and back. Now, today, the burro races just go to the top of Mosquito Pass and back. The I did some mountain climbing. I shouldn't call it mountain climbing. I just walked up a big hill. I didn't know anything about mountain climbing. I walked up a hill. I went up Mount Elbert, the highest peak in Colorado, just down from Leadville. And at the top, I ran into snow, sleet, hail, rain, fog, the whole top of the... So I had no view from the top of that.
Oh.
The time I got up there...
What time of year was this?
This was July 4th.
On July 4th.
Yeah. Then just adjacent to Climax is Mount Arkansas. And I went up there twice. Almost got killed both times.
Oh, my.
Well, no. The first time... Two of us went walking up a big hill, and you know, on many of these hills, you get up here and it looks like a hill, crest is here. So you go up here and the crest is up here, and you go up there and the crest is up here further. Well, we got looking and the gosh, it's about 4 o'clock and it's going to get dark before long. So we started back and we came to a place, it was a kind of a V-shaped crevasse, not a hole, but in which snow was packed in, kind of a poor man's glacier in there. And we had to go down this thing. Now, how do you get down it? Because at the bottom of the snow was a talus slope. And if you broke loose going down there, you would really wreck yourself up on the stones at the bottom of the slope. So we finally figured out
that hadn't had to cross it to get up?
We climbed up adjacent to it, but trying to climb down was very difficult. And so finally we figured out how to do it. You had to turn around and face outward, so you're looking down the talus slope, and then dig your heels or your boots in the snow as you went down.
Just sort of ski down on your boots.
The next time I went up there was in the... when I was up there the second time, and the Mount Arkansas, as many of the mountains are glacial cirques, where the glaciers, well, there was a, as you get near the top, there are two glacial cirques, so you have kind of a ridge. Well, it was rotted, you know, the rocks were pretty weathered and so forth. So you had to kind of straddle the thing and move along that way. When you get up there, of course, you find a USGS monument that was put up there in 1872 or something. But as we were coming back, an electrical storm moved up the valley from near Leadville. And you could see it coming. There were a lot of them that move up. We knew that, you know, you knew that. Many afternoons you'd get an electrical storm moving up from Leadville up the valley, Arkansas Valley. This is at on one side of Climax, right on the Continental Divide, on one side the Arkansas goes down into the Arkansas River and ends up in the Gulf, and the other side goes to the Pacific. And as soon as we got off that crumbly ridge, we ran, and it was going a very steep slope, but we ran anyway, got off the, we didn't want to be the highest thing up there.
No, no, no.
Anyway, I was dumb and I didn't know anything. No. Better do that. I used to tour the state a lot. A friend of mine, Stan Shack, worked for the Arkansas Valley Smelter of Asarco at a place called Stringtown, which was just south of Leadville, part of Leadville. And then there were the Scussell twins, Hank and Jean, S-C-U-S-S-E-L, who had gone to Texas Western, well at that time Texas College of Mines, and it was changed to Texas Western and now is University of Texas El Paso. But anyway, they had graduated mining there and they were working up there. Then later, when I was up there a second time, Cal Brannon, whose father was chief metallurgist for Electromet Division of Union Carbide, he and I used to go around. Turned out later, when I worked for Carbide, Cal was working for International Minerals and Chemicals across the street. He'd gone back to Carnegie Mellon and finished up his Chem-E degree, and so he was working Chem-E. The electrical storms could be rather nasty. If they'd hit the central station, and suddenly the mill would be this deathly silent. Nothing was running, and of course there's pulp running every place. Well, they had designed for that, so they had good overflows and good washouts and everything else, so they'd get the mill back on the line pretty fast after the power came back on. There's another interesting thing connected with this, which I have done a lot of work, research work, since I've been here, and I incorporated into my teaching of suspension stability. I don't know of anyone in mineral processing that spends as much time on suspension stability. And every place I've been, suspension stability is important. Yet at Homestake, it was important. If you tried to shut down the CCD pilot plant, once you got the solids in the agitators down to about 10-12%, the load would drop like a rock. And you run the risk of sanding the agitator. And then we had high pressure air diffusers. We could bubble and keep it stirred up. But I also ran into suspension stability problems at Union Carbide and at Kennecott. But the biggest one was Climax. Our tailings went down the mountain and if you've ever driven by there, you've seen the big tailings that sit on top of the old town of Kokomo. Well, they went down the hill. They didn't grow quite as far as Kokomo, because Kokomo still existed. And then the water was decanted and pumped back into the circuit. To get the tailings down there, because we had a coarse grind, the material settled very rapidly. And in order to keep it from settling rapidly, you had to maintain at least 50% solids. Now, when you shut down and start up a mill, you've got water all over the place, and you no longer don't even anything remotely resembling 50% solids. So you run the risk of plugging that tailing line. What they had initially was a critical slope out behind the mill. They had a very, very flat, with essentially no elevation on the pipe at all. And if it was going to sand any place, that's where it would sand, and we had a dump pond.
Mm-hmm.
They also, when I first went up there, had a redwood stave pipe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dating from, I don't know, 1915 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a snowshoe patrol with snowshoes and axes. And if anything happened to that pipeline, they went over and went out and chopped a hole in the pipeline to keep it running. Because if it ever sanded up and froze, they'd be shut down. Now, later, the thing was cured in a different way. They put in a thickener and then had instrumentation on the thickener so that nothing less than 50% solids could get into the pipeline. The other thing they did, and this was, I think it was developed by Warren Wilson. He was later, he was at Colorado School of Mines, and later was president of Rapid School of Mines in Rapid City, three, 4 years. And they had a thing we call jumps and risers. The tailings are coming down a line, and you run the risk of having the coarse particles settle out a little preferentially to the fines, and then all of a sudden you plug it. So what they did, they'd come along, and then they would have kind of like a silo, and they'd dump it down the silo, which would mix it all up again, and then they'd put it back in a tailing line, take it down another few hundred feet, and put another jump in and do that. To keep it from sanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been able to incorporate, now I'll show you this, I've been able to incorporate a lot of these practical things from industry
mm-hmm.
into,
mm-hmm.
and I've done a fair amount of research as well on suspension stability, under what conditions is it stable. The other thing that was interesting, the Denver Rio Grande Western was still running several narrow gauges. They had shut down the line from Gunnison to Montrose, but they still had a line that went over Marshall Pass into Gunnison. They had, they still ran the line, went in over, came from Slida, followed the Marshall Pass line, and then split off and went into San Luis Valley. So it ended up in Alamosa, then went to Chama, New Mexico, and then the line ran roughly along the border between those two states, and ended up in Durango.
Mm.
They had one line then went down to Farmington.
Mm.
And this was, you remember that there was, in the 50s, there was a big oil boom down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought pipe down. They trained after train of pipe.
Mm.
And then they also had another branch that ran up to Silverton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is 63 miles of the line from Antonito, Colorado to Chama, New Mexico that is being run as called the Cumbres and Toltec. And it's still running. It runs over Cumbres Pass. It runs as a tourist operation.
Mm-hmm.
It's owned by the states of New Mexico and Colorado. They bought the roadbed, and then they have a company that has the original rolling stock, including the rotary snowplows and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a big tourist operation.
Mm-hmm.
There's another big tourist operation, the Durango and Silverton.
Right.
That runs you know, every summer. Then there was another narrow gauge called Rio Grande Southern. It started at Ridgeway, which is just north of Ouray. The problem is they couldn't connect Silverton to Ouray. They got over Red Mountain Pass, but not easily.
No.
And they had to have switchbacks, and they had to use a turnstile, and you know, they had a lot of things. They had to put the locomotive in, turnstile, and take it off, and then take a car, and it was a mess. But they couldn't get all the way down the million-dollar highway area into Ouray.
Mm-hmm.
So the Rio Grande Southern came along. This would be 1885. And starting Ridgeway has a narrow gauge, runs over to Telluride. Then the Telluride is a branch. Then it went over Lizard's Head Pass into Noriko, Dolores, and then around the south of the San Juans into Durango.
See, Lizard's Head Pass into
Durango.
Rico, you said first?
No. Lizard's Head Pass, Rico, R-I-C-O.
Right.
Rico is where they got a lot of the pyrite to make sulfuric acid for the uranium boom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The what to make sulfuric acid?
Pyrite.
Oh, pyrite. Okay.
So Rico was running until the uranium boom started going down.
Uh-huh.
Or actually until the copper smelter gas, sulfuric acid, started displacing them.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran narrow gauge. Not only locomotive, times got tough, so they put in what was called a galloping goose. They took an old Rio speed wagon. They pulled out the differential and they put in a sprocket and they used a chain drive. They pulled off the wheels and put on railroad tires.
Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures.
And then they had a box in the back. There were seven geese. They were called galloping goose. And the reason they're galloping goose, they used very, very light rail. Some of them was as light as 20-pound rail. And if you looked at the Rio Grande rail, it went like that, wiggled, snaked along and in both the horizontal and vertical directions.
Uh-huh.
So as you rode along the thing, it would bounce, i.e. gallop.
Uh-huh.
And where the goose came from, I don't know. But anyway, galloping goose. And they had seven of these geese. One of them is gone, number one, but the rest still exist.
Mm-hmm.
Three of them are at the Colorado Railroad Museum in Golden.
Mm-hmm.
One is in Knott's Berry Farm.
Mm-hmm.
One is in Dolores. And one is downtown Telluride.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen them all. I purposely went on Knott's Berry Farm. The only thing I wanted to see is the goose. But even though they had all that stuff. And I was just north of Salida,
mm-hmm.
and where the main transfer station from narrow to standard gauge.
Mm-hmm.
I never rode narrow gauge.
No.
I'm now a narrow gauge buff, so I've ridden all the narrow gauges.
Uh-huh, but you didn't then.
In those days, which is a shame.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's talk about the second time I was up at Climax, 1953.
What did you do in between?
I was at University of Washington.
Okay.
And we're going to come to that.
All right.
So, I was at University of Washington from September of 51 until June of 53.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to go in September, I was going to go to MIT. So mm-hmm. that summer I went up back up on the Molly Hill.
I see.
they had started to move the camp from the hill down to Leadville. And so I looked for a room in Leadville.
Why were they doing that? Because they were
They were going to mine a lot of that area. Plus, I think they didn't want to be in the house business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all the maintenance and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the houses, they essentially sold the house for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And helped truck them down to Leadville and build them, reset them down to Leadville. So I looked for a room in Leadville. I first stayed in the Vendome Hotel for a couple of days. And I'd forgotten all about this until I read Frank McQuistion's oral history.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes living in the Vendome Hotel. He was working for Newmont at the Resurrection Mining Company at that time during World War II. And he describes the Vendome Hotel. This was probably built, I think, in 84, something like that, 1884. And it was originally called the Tabor Grand, and then later was changed to the Vendome. Well, today, the Vendome sits kind of forlorn. It's still sitting.
Mm-hmm.
Forlorn, shorn of its magnificence, across from the Golden Burrow Cafe. But when I stayed there, I stayed on the second floor. The hill slopes down rather precipitously, so I had a back room, and as you looked out the back room, you weren't just one story high. First place, they had these very high stories, particularly for the lobby. And then the hill slammed down. The fire escape was a box. And in the box was two chains, and about every foot was a crossbar. And you threw the that thing out, and it climbed down. Well, of course, you can imagine when you had a long ways to go, it's going to sway back and forth. I had pretty well decided if there was a fire and I had to get out, I wasn't going to go out that way. But a lot of hotels had fire escapes like that at that time. Just a box, and you open the box and you throw the chain out. I finally went over and got a room at the Quincy Hotel, which is still sitting there. I worked in the 2 years I was gone. They had built mill number 3 and were building mill number 4 across the street from the original mill. And I was working on tin recovery using thing called a tilting frame and mill recovery problems. I go through Leadville every few years. Last time was last July, and July 97. And it's had a strong shape up over the years. So they painted the houses, they've got the old original Tabor house is well painted and fixed up and available for tourists. The National Mining Museum is there in the old high school up on the hill, and which is a wonderful operation. They've really done just a magnificent job on that. And so the whole town looks a lot different to look like because I guess they're not taxed for putting paint on the outside of the building.
I guess not.
They're running quite a good tourist business. There's a good bookstore on the main street of Western books. And I always stop there and buy a few books. I probably have left, close to $100 of my money back there.
I'm sure.
The last one. And then skiing. There is Cooper Hill just a few miles away, which where the 10th Mountain Division trained in World War II. Mm. But, you know, they're close to Breckenridge, Keystone, A-Basin, Copper Mountain, Vail, and all those places are very pricey.
Mm-hmm.
So you could stay in Leadville a lot cheaper
mm-hmm.
and drive over. And Colorado Highway Department, in my opinion, is probably the best highway department, winter highway department in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I have been over Loveland Pass. This was before the Eisenhower Tunnel was built. This would be, say, 1951, something like that. I've been over Loveland Pass in a blizzard at 3 o'clock in the morning and meant three pieces of snow removal equipment, including two rotary plows.
Wow.
So what Colorado does is they take some passes, such as Independence Pass between Leadville and Aspen, and just let them snow in.
Mm-hmm.
They don't bother with them. Just block them off, and you can go. You'll be welcome to go the second week of June. But those that they do keep open, they do just a tremendous job. I've been over a lot of passes,
mm-hmm.
and the highway department has really done a magnificent
mm-hmm.
job. And so I tell you, I vote those people number one.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, there were slag heaps on both ends of Leadville, and then there was a big slag heap the south of Leadville at Stringtown, the old Asarco Arkansas Valley smelter. It was lead smelter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're removing the slag at the end of Harrison Avenue, east end of Harrison Avenue, the main drag.
Mm-hmm.
For quite a few years, the Sarco site has been a Superfund site,
mm.
and they've got that pretty well camouflaged. I was impressed with what they've done there. I guess I could summarize. It was a wonderful learning experience. I still keep friendships after 50 years,
mm.
particularly Lou Cope, who was on the staff with me at the, he also came out of Texas College Mines.
Mm.
Lou is a consulting metallurgist in Denver, but Lou and I were on staff together,
mm.
so I always keep up with Lou, with Ed Froling, who's now down in Tucson,
mm-hmm.
and with Bud. Dixie Christmer later married Bud Windolf, so
mm-hmm.
I've got one Christmas card that goes to two good friends that mm-hmm. place with Bud and Dixie mm-hmm. at the same time. So I had a wonderful learning experience, and I was really mm-hmm. thankful. But I think I described that
mm-hmm.
byproducts plant that was really fascinating.
Sounds as if it was. Mm-hmm.
Anyone interested, I've written up the byproducts plant in one of the rare earth volumes published by TMS.
Oh.
Edited by R.G. Bautista.
TMS is what?
The Metallurgical Society.
Right.
It's part of AIME.
Okay.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's quit.
That's a good place to start.
I've got mm-hmm. UW.